This is Salman Rushdie.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney.
I'm Neil deGrasse Tyson.
This is Theo Wilson.
Hi, this is Dar Williams, and you're listening to the
Humanist Network
Humanist
News.
Network
Humanist
News.
Network Humanist News. Network News.
It's July 22nd, and you're listening to Humanist Network News, an audio production of the American Humanist Association, and I'm your host, Jenda Huang.
And I'm your host, Jess Constantine. We are podcasting live from the Stephen Yule Imagine No Superstition podcast studio in Albany, New York. Jenda, welcome to Albany.
Thank you very much. This is my first time here and my first time in this little room. And I have to say, like you said last month, it is a little scary.
Yeah,
it actually reminds me of, you know, I grew up Catholic and went to confession and all that. And this kind of reminds me, like, you know, because we have all this stuff to prevent any of the sound going out. And I think they set up little confessional chambers the same way. And so just coming in here, that kind of quiet hum and like the lack of any other noise is reminiscent of my earlier days.
So, Jenna, tell me all your sins.
This podcast only goes for an hour, so I don't think we can get through all them.
Nice. Okay, so that's what you think of our little podcast studio here. Tell me, what are your thoughts about Albany? I just picked you up from the airport about an hour ago, and you got to see some of the not-so-pretty parts and then some of the quote-unquote highlights of Albany. So what are your thoughts?
I'm definitely coming back next month with a camera. That the Capitol buildings area, all that is, I didn't realize it was designed like that. I just thought it would be, you know, like kind of a state dome or whatever, and a few low-slung buildings here and there. And I didn't realize that downtown Albany looked like, you know, something out of Star Wars and the Death Star or something like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. So. And for listeners, he's referring to, I believe, in our Empire State Plaza, which sounds very, very Star Wars by itself, right? Empire Strikes Back.
Very much.
The building that we call the Egg, which is shaped like an egg, believe it or not.
Yeah, it looks like it's about ready to take off.
Isn't it?
And head in orbit anyway.
Have you seen the Flight of the Navigator? It looks like it's that spaceship.
Yeah. Considering the politics that are happening up here, maybe the governor does want to leave, actually. So
that's funny. So we've got another jam-packed show for our listeners this month.
Yeah, we do. We're going to be hearing from three awardees from the AHA's 68th annual conference down in Phoenix, Arizona.
That's right. We'll hear from Barbara Forrest, who received the Humanist Pioneer Award. And she's also a professor of philosophy at Southeastern Louisiana University.
And we're going to be hearing from Donald Johansson, who is a keynote speaker and is the discoverer of the famous hominid fossil Lucy, which, was named after Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, I believe.
Naturally. and first, we're going to actually hear from our HNN interview with Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, who you folks heard last month giving his thank you comments. Our very own Jenda Huang interviews Dr. deGrasse Tyson with Jennifer Barty, who edits the AHA magazine, The Humanist. You folks caught up with Dr. Tyson last month.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Barty. I'm the editor of The Humanist magazine, and I'm here on Humanist Network News speaking with Neil deGrasse Tyson. We're at the 68th Annual American Humanist Association Conference in Phoenix. So, Dr. Tyson, great to be here with you. Welcome. Is this your first Humanist conference?
My very first. I didn't even know they existed. I've been a little out of it. I just being a scientist all my life. So
you've been thinking about Pluto too much and other things like that, right?
Yeah, something. You know, somebody's got to do it. So
well, we're really glad that you're here and that you've discovered us in a sense. What are your impressions so far?
Well, I've only been here just about 12 hours, but I mean, everybody's friendly and the topics are all very interesting, and it's clear that there's quite there's a lot of work to be done to try to make sure we have the country that we all thought we were given 230 years ago when it was founded.
Do you consider yourself a humanist, Neil deGrasse Tyson?
I don't associate with any ist. In fact, in my talk that I'll be giving later today, no ists or isms. I guess I'm a scientist. That's my ist. But in terms of movements, no, I never identified with any movement. I just am what I am, and occasionally a movement claims me because there's resonance between my writings and speeches and what they do. And that's fine. I don't mind that. But no, I've never been politically or organizationally active in that way.
This is a group, this is sort of a coming together of fellow travelers, you might say, like-minded kind of ideologies, worldviews. And so it's kind of a big tent, and everyone's welcome. There's a lot of discussion, and I'm sure you'll hear it throughout the weekend, about should we label ourselves, should we not? And I think you make a good point. I mean, if we're going to label ourselves according to everything, single thing we're interested in and may identify with at any given moment, well, this is going to be pretty long. So we'll just refer to you as Neil deGrasse Tyson, extraordinaire.
Neil deGrasse Tyson, astrophysicist.
Now, can you give us just kind of maybe a teaser about what you're going to talk about today?
Well, I'm actually not going to give a talk. I know in advance that I'm receiving the Isaac Asimov Science Communicator Award or some award with a title such as that. And I'll have some sort of thank you remarks. But those thank you remarks will be designed to sort of stimulate the audience's further inquiry into what I do and why I do it. And so what I'm looking forward to is a vibrant sort of question and answer session in the room there. Everyone in the room, we know, will be strongly opinionated about one thing or another, and everyone has different, though resonant, life experiences dealing with the public, dealing with dogma, and the forces that dogma bring to bear on society. So I look forward to hearing what they say in comparison to what I handed them in my welcome, in my thank you remarks.
Great. We're really looking forward to it. As a scientist, as an astrophysicist, do you find it a challenge with mainly maybe with groups like this that they're maybe less interested in the actual science that you're doing, and they want to hear more about your position on science in our culture?
I have no problems with people asking me anything about anything, provided it's something I've thought about or written about or spoken about. And the relationship of science to our culture is of fundamental importance in this, the 21st century, where whether or not we embrace science as a nation will play directly into our ability to compete economically with other nations that already value what it is to invest in science and technology. And so whatever people feel the need to explore with me, I'm happy to go there with them. I spend enough of the rest of my life as an expositor of the frontier of science. I don't need to do that every time I'm in front of an audience. Clearly, this audience has an important mission ahead of it, and I'd be very happy to share my life experiences with regard to that mission and just compare notes and see, look for best practices and look for worst practices. In the category of worst practices, there are occasions where people, be they humanist or atheist, or just completely obnoxious, you know, when in having a conversation with others. And that we all know that's the wrong way to be. And I even had a tussle with Richard Dawkins. I think it's my most viewed YouTube video clip, is where I accuse him of being completely ineffective because he's so sharp of wit in the service of his point of view. And he's so well-educated that someone who's just has some feelings would just be squashed by it. And I accused him of not fulfilling the directive of the title that he carried, which at the time was Professor of the Public Understanding of Science. That implies that you have to, that your conversation with another person is an act of persuasion in some way. It's not, you're not hitting them over the head, not that kind of persuasion. You want to understand what's going on in their mind and sort of meet them there. Otherwise, you're not as effective as you can be. Now, he's been hugely popular with his books and his speeches. So it's not like the guy is not effective.
Right.
But I'm convinced he could be much more effective than he has been. And so, yeah, I think there are worse practices out there, and I think some of that needs to shake out. And my goal is not to get people to believe one thing or another, as may be the objective of so many others at this conference. My goal is to get people to be scientifically literate and to observe the world as something to investigate, not something to either fear or be mysteriously befuddled by, to the point where you're driven to supernatural explanations. Because the history of our investigation of the universe is one where supernatural explanations fall in the face of naturalist explanations. And so there's no reason to presume that going forward, we would need to change that approach to our knowing.
That's really interesting. I think people will argue that Dawkins and Hitchens and these figures are raising the profile of certain non-theistic voice, the non-theistic voice in general. But I think human beings are complex and conflicted at times. And I think that there's certainly reasonable to think about retailoring your approach once you've got the spotlight. I try to talk about that to groups like this, that, claiming the truth is a whole lot more boring and unattractive than sort of seeking it. And certainly in science, you want to ask questions, and then you want to go in search of the answers. So I do think scientists, as working as scientists and touching on these issues, are really the best spokespeople that we could hope for. So thank you so much for being here.
So you just put that much greater burden on my shoulder, saying that scientists now have to carry even more. First, we got to figure out how the universe works. Then we got to get it out there to the public. My gosh!
Your ability to communicate, your science and your ideas is really sharp. And as a writer and as a presenter, do you find that you have a very specific technique for communicating?
Yeah, technique implies that there's a method that gets invoked. And then you repeat that method because it has shown to be successful. What I found is that one shouldn't have any method at all because everyone is different. And so therefore, you have to be prepared to communicate with any audience at any time, at any age, in any demographic, at any political leaning, level of tolerance for humor, religious leanings, all of these factors influence the ability of a person to receive the message you're giving them. And so there, it's not a technique. A technique implies, here, you do this, and you work. And no. You have to be much more fluid than that. And part of the fluidity, part of what empowers the fluidity, is your exposure to pop culture when you're talking to the public. So you've got to know what the hit TV shows are, at least seen a few of them. You've got to know what Paris Hilton was up to. You've got to have watched some television, yes. You've got to have seen some sporting events. These are what matters to the general public in their casual conversations they might have at a cocktail party or at the bar or, at the laundromat. And if you walk in there as an educator in any discipline and you're not prepared to engage what interests them as a stepping stone or as metaphor or as a means of fleshing out a conversation in ways that have emotional, intellectual, and cultural relevance to your audience, you're not going to be communicating. And all too many educators just deliver a lecture and you either receive it or you don't. They're not speaking with regard to the ability of their listener to receive their message. And so I hold it as my highest priority to understand the audience I'm about to speak with, so that words that I use, the rhythm of my sentences, the references that I make are all tuned for that audience at that time. This is what makes the modern day reposting of YouTube a little more difficult for me, because I'll give a speech or a talk to an audience specific to that audience, and then it gets lifted onto YouTube and now anybody can watch it. And so all I can guarantee you is that if you were there in the room, it would have felt much more real than anything you would have seen on YouTube, because I'm reacting to the room. I'm not just giving a speech that then gets posted for everyone to see. And so I challenge my fellow educators and scientists and others who have a mission of enlightenment for the public to become the public. Spend some time doing that, and you can only be more effective rather than less after you've done so. I once gave a talk to the National Science Teachers Association. This is an important group of people, K-12 educators in science. And I asked, by show of hands, how many people, because I knew this would get an interesting reply, how many people do not own a television? Half the hands went up. Of those who own a television, I asked, how many hardly ever watch it, maybe for Netflix? Half the hands went up. So fully three quarters of that audience, whose job it is to teach the next generation science, do not watch television, yet the average American watches 30 or 40 hours of television a week. Mm-hmm. That disconnect is pedagogically fatal. And, well, you can get on your high horse and say, well, TV is just the undermining of all that is good in society. Doesn't change the fact that it's the most influential force that's out there. And if you don't know the magnitude of that force and what direction it's pointing, then you'll be correspondingly less effective standing up in front of the room. And don't then afterwards come up to me and say, oh, they just don't want to learn. Oh, they're not, it's not a good class. They don't want to listen.
Right.
Excuse me, it's your job to get them interested enough to want to listen. Otherwise, do not count yourself among the ranks of educators. Take up another field of work.
I imagine it was a little bit controversial. well, you know, and you think about, you know, if you're going to invoke sort of popular culture as metaphor or just a really a way to relate to your audience, and then you, excuse me, maybe you're using a show, I'm trying to think of one, I don't know, I don't watch The Simpsons, but I've been told it's great social commentary. So, and you're probably going to give me a hard time for not watching The Simpsons, but so then you've got that layer. I mean, if they're actually making some decent points, then you can reference that in your classroom. I mean, do you think that's the way to go?
Well, you have to watch out what it is you reference, because there are programs on TV that may have a following, but their ratings are sufficiently low that it won't work as a reference in a room full of people, because you don't have enough of a guarantee that the show is popular enough for your reference to work. The Simpsons is rife with social commentary, so is Family Guy. And so, so these kinds of shows can actually give you interesting insight into how to treat certain content when you're reaching the public. But when I say pop culture, I don't mean only the shows that are just kind of cool and interesting that are on TV. I mean the absolute bar none hit shows. I'm talking about Dances with Stars. I'm talking about the reality shows, which most educators thumb their noses at as being of no educational or intellectual value. Yet clearly millions of people watch it every week. So there's a disconnect. As long as there's a disconnect, you're not communicating.
Do you work with like kids much? I know you've talked about getting letters from kids and things like that. Do you work in sort of science education?
Hardly any of my professional activities are directly targeting children. Where I work, my day job at the American Museum of Natural History, there's an entire education department that has people hired who are trained in K-12 cognitive processes and curricula and this sort of thing. So they actually plan events and activities. Occasionally I'm needed for that and I'm tapped and I come in and I'll make a presentation to the kids, but I didn't conceive the event. That's done by those who are more qualified to do it. Now, that being said, there are books I've written that are very readable by kids. The TV show that I host, Nova Science Now, has a sort of playful spirit to it that kids can watch it, and I think get quite a bit out of it. But it's on at 9 p.m. this summer, you know, on Tuesdays. How do you like that for the plug? 9 p.m. this summer. But that's later than what a younger kid would consider programming intended for them. So, no, but to the extent that kids follow, that's fine. I won't resist that. But I can tell you that the urge to stimulate science literacy in children is sometimes done at the cost, at the expense of raising science literacy among adults. Adults far outnumber children. Adults vote. Adults run the country. They run the world. There's nothing scarier than a scientifically literate adult with a finger on the button.
Right.
So much of my efforts have been to re-stimulate a level of science curiosity in adults that we all had as children. And then we get the whole society participating in the enterprise.
Right, that's fascinating. I think, because I know I've been to the Science Center in Baltimore, and it's completely geared towards kids. And it's, you know, you take your kids there and they run around and they do all kinds of stuff, but as an adult, you really don't get much. And that's a really good point, because I think you're right, kids have the scientific mind sort of already. I know my daughter came, she's four, so she came home from preschool and told me she'd learned about gravity. And I asked her what gravity was, and she said, things float. So she's working it out. I think she's working it out in her mind what it is. But that's fascinating. So I think a lot of, well, this is a receptive audience to science. So I think you'll get a lot of great questions. I think that's it. Thanks for talking to us.
Well, thanks for having me here at the conference and for the interview.
This is Tawny Hale, and you're listening to Humanist Network News.
And I'm your host, Jenda Huang.
And I'm your host, Jess Constantine. That was an interview with Jenda and editor of the Humanist magazine, Jennifer Bardi, with Neil deGrasse Tyson. You can learn more about Dr. Tyson from his website, haydenplanetarium.org/Tyson. You should also look for Dr. Tyson appearing on various Comedy Central shows, such as The Colbert Report.
Now we're going to hear from Dr. Barbara Forrest. She received the Humanist Pioneer Award. She's a professor of philosophy at Southeastern Louisiana University and is the co-author of Creationism's Trojan Horse, The Wedge of Intelligent Design, which kind of goes into the political and religious aims of the intelligent design / creationist movement. She was also actually an expert witness for the plaintiffs in the very first legal case that involved intelligent design, which was Kitzmiller versus Dover Area School District.
Jenda and Jennifer caught up with Barbara Forrest last month at the conference.
I'm Jenda Huang with Humanist Network News, and I am here with Dr. Barbara Forrest, of professor of philosophy at Southeastern Louisiana University, and she is also the 2009 Humanist Pioneer Award winner.
And I'm Jennifer Bardi with the Humanist Magazine.
Great. And you got your award yesterday, and you did a presentation regarding intelligent design and whatnot. And I'm wondering, for the listeners who weren't able to be here, could you maybe give a brief synopsis, not so much specifically about what you talked about, which was kind of a lot of history and stuff, but I mean, what is the status of the intelligent design movement like right now? Are they kind of regrouping after the Dover trial, or are they what's the situation with them right now?
Oh, they're very much regrouping. As soon as the Dover trial was over, in fact, even before the Dover trial, they were already changing their strategy to adopt different language to avoid the term intelligent design. And after the Dover trial, they became even more concerned to change the language that they were using to promote intelligent design. So now they're adopting code language such as teaching the strengths and weaknesses of evolution. And they're sponsoring, or they are coordinating the introduction of what they're calling academic freedom legislation in states around the country. And they've coordinated the introduction of such legislation in 7 or 8 different states over the last 2 years. But so far, my state of Louisiana is the only state in which that legislation has passed. So they're promoting legislation right now.
Is their new tactic going to be more difficult to defeat than what they were doing with intelligent design?
This tactic they're using now is much sneakier. Although we predicted it, we knew it was coming, and we can certainly trace the language they're using to language, the euphemisms and code language that's been used by creationists literally for decades. So it was predictable. We can trace the current tactic to earlier creationist tactics, which were exactly the same. The problem with it is, since the language is sanitized and they're avoiding the use of the term intelligent design, it's trickier to handle in terms of trying to argue against it to legislators, for example, who are taken in by the fact that this legislation doesn't mention intelligent design. So it does make it more difficult to deal with, yes.
And it seems that this new approach, too, is trying to defend academic freedom. And so they are appearing to be sort of champions of that. Do you agree?
Well, they're trying that, although it's easy to expose it as a creationist tactic, because creationists have been talking about academic freedom literally for decades, 30 or 40 years. And what's interesting is, in 1981, when Louisiana passed an earlier creationist bill, a creation science bill, which was litigated and declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, that bill was explicitly defended as promoting academic freedom. So it's very easy to show that this is a ruse. It's a trick, except that it's designed to evade the courts by avoiding the use of the term creationism. So even though it's very easy to see through it and very easy to expose it, it makes it legally more difficult to deal with.
Mm-hmm. But is it the same, in essence, the same fight for you, or the same challenge to show that what they're suggesting replacing the theory of evolution with is not science? Does it remain the same basic?
I've already done that. I wrote an extensive and a detailed analysis of the Louisiana bill that was introduced. And it's very easy to show where these bills come from. They come from the Discovery Institute, which has already been exposed as a creationist organization. The language of the bills can very easily be traced directly back to their creationist context. So that's very easy to do. I've already done that.
Mm-hmm.
But convincing a bunch of legislators what's going on is not so easy to do. The other thing, though, that makes these bills difficult is that they are usually sponsored by legislators who are working in a coordination with the religious right. And in Louisiana, the religious right, for all practical purposes, is running the Louisiana legislature when it comes to conservative social policy.
Mm-hmm.
And they have an ally in our governor, Bobby Jindal. And so in Louisiana, those were the circumstances that combined to make it impossible for us to defeat that bill. It didn't matter how we explained it or how much evidence we had what the bill was. We just didn't have the political momentum on our side.
Mm-hmm. One thing you said in your remarks that was so funny, in talking about the evangelical Christian community, and I think the Discovery Institute cast of characters, you said they've given me all my best lines, actually.
Yeah.
Do you see them continuing to be funded, sometimes maybe more so with every defeat, but do you see their strength waning at all?
They are... I think they're being taken less seriously by the media. They were getting quite a bit of media attention for a number of years. That's not so much the case anymore. But one thing we've learned about creationists is that they never, ever go away.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that keeps them in business is the fact that there are too many Americans who continue to support them. They never have trouble raising money.
Mm-hmm.
They always have more money than... organizations, for example, such as the National Center for Science Education. I mean, we certainly don't have the funding that they always seem to have. The Discovery Institute apparently has no trouble getting their donors to pony up the dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And they will be in business as long as Americans continue to support this type of thing. There are enough Americans who support it to keep them going. And that has never been a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just have to keep moving from one battle to the next. We're always fighting rear guard actions. And it's been a matter of our always having to respond to these people rather than being proactive. And I think that's one of the places where they get the jump on us.
Uh-huh.
They never stop. They don't do mm-hmm. any real constructive work. The people who oppose them have real jobs and families. We
right.
have constructive work to do. We don't do nothing except lobby legislators and go out and lobby school boards, which means that we end up having to respond to them and try to catch up to them, because this is all they do. They do
right.
nothing except this, and they don't really have any constructive work to do the way we do.
Well, and because they're doing this all the time,
you're spending
a lot of your time on this, but what else do you do? I mean, in your classes, how much time do you spend on this, and what other things do you typically teach?
In most of my classes, I don't spend any time on this at all. I teach a couple of classes in which I do spend some time. I have a graduate seminar in the history of Western thought, and my grad students have to read Darwin. And I use Philip Appleman's Norton Critical Reader, which has a selection from Darwin's writings, and it also has a chapter on creationism. And so after my students learn about Darwin's ideas and the ideas of people who were his contemporaries, then if we have time, we move into the discussion of creationism. And I teach a class periodically. Well, I've taught it twice. It's a special topics class for undergraduates called The History and Principles of Evolution. And at the end of the semester, after my students have learned the proper science and the proper terminology and the evidence for evolution, then we sometimes get to touch on this, but it's always after they've learned what they need to learn to tell the difference between real science and creationism.
Okay. Well, that seems like the right order to do it.
Yeah, but in my regular classes, no, this doesn't come up.
So, I mean, yeah, I was kind of ask about that. Do any of your students know about your reputation beforehand and kind of come in with being like, oh, I know about you and all your things about intelligent design and, you know, I have a problem with that?
Well, some of them know about it, but they don't give me flack about it. They're fascinated with it. I have a reputation, but it's more for being a demanding professor and making people write term papers than it is for fighting creationists.
Well, like you said, I mean, I think it's really interesting to find out what else, you know, people on this side of the argument are doing, because I think it would be actually very unsatisfying if you devoted your entire career to this, although it would certainly be a good fight. But these people at the Discovery Institute and others who are pushing these ideas, typically they sometimes have some science credentials, but in your opinion, I mean, have they ever practiced science? I mean, do they have a real grasp even of the science world?
There are a few real scientists in this group, but they either don't do science at all or they're not in the areas of science in which evolution plays a prominent role. There are two particular examples that are interesting at the Discovery Institute. One of them is Michael Behe, who is a biochemist. Mm-hmm. He's not an evolutionary biologist, but he's a biochemist who has a regular job. He teaches at Lehigh University. But in his professional work as a scientist, what he does to make his living at Lehigh University, he doesn't do intelligent design. He does not use intelligent design as a scientific principle in his professional work that he does to make a living. He promotes intelligent design on the side, but he spends a substantial amount of time doing that. But as a professional scientist, he doesn't use it at all, which is very telling. He doesn't go to scientific conferences and talk about intelligent design, you know. So that's very interesting that even though he promotes it, he doesn't use it, right? And the other guy that's interesting is Jonathan Wells, who has a PhD in biology, right, which he earned at the University of California, Berkeley, finished up in 2000, and has done absolutely no science since. Mm-hmm. All he does is promote intelligent design. So the one person among the leaders who's been trained in evolutionary biology or in molecular biology, I think it was actually probably developmental biology that Wells did, which strongly involves evolution, got that PhD to use as cover, to give himself the facade of respectability, but only to promote intelligent design, not to do science. He doesn't do any science at all.
Mm-hmm. Changing gears a little bit, Dr. Forrest, do you consider yourself a humanist?
No, actually I don't, because I don't like to put labels on mm-hmm. myself. I don't really consider myself as having a label of any kind. I endorse the principles that humanists endorse, but those are just the principles that any rational, intelligent person, I think, would find very agreeable.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've never actually put the label humanist on myself, oddly enough, even though I'm a member of the board of directors of the New Orleans Secular Humanist Association. I never, ever refer to myself as a humanist. I don't really refer to myself with any particular label. I'm a teacher. I'm a mother. I'm a citizen. I do lots of things to fulfill those roles, but I'm not an ist.
Yeah.
As Dr. deGrasse Tyson said last night, I'm not an ist.
Right. You're maybe an right?
I used to be a Methodist.
You're a former ist.
Yeah.
You did say something else last night, that the evangelical Christian community is mostly male and mostly white.
The Discovery Institute. The evangelicals who comprise the Discovery Institute, the intelligent design creationist movement, are largely white male Protestant evangelicals. There are a few Catholics in there.
Mm-hmm.
There's at least one Jew, not a practicing Jew. And there's a Muslim that supports them, and there's reputedly an agnostic. But this is almost exclusively a white male Protestant evangelical movement,
mm-hmm.
with a few Catholics thrown in.
But their supporters must be a little bit more diverse if they have so many
Not really. Their supporters are almost exclusively Protestant evangelicals.
Mm-hmm.
And that there is a far-right contingent of Catholics that supports them. But this is very... In fact, I have actually gave a talk one time for Women's History Month, and my title was Intelligent Design, Male and Pale. You know, because it's very male and very pale. Right. Women do not play a prominent role in this. They play, to the extent that they're involved, they play subservient roles.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Do you find that most philosophers or philosophy educators are non-theistic?
I don't know, because I don't ask. What's interesting is, when I was a graduate student in philosophy at LSU, most of the professors in that department were quite religious. But number one, I don't hang out with philosophers very much. I mean, I just don't. I'm in the company of scientists and teachers and people like that. And what's interesting is that when I'm working with people who are involved in this effort to counteract creationism, we don't talk about each other's religious beliefs very much. We really don't. Mm-hmm. We don't even ask, because it's not important to us. There are a few people who make it a point to talk about their beliefs because they believe it's important to communicate to the public. One is Kenneth Miller,
right?
Who's a cell biologist, who's a very devout Catholic and is a very good spokesman, a communicator to the religious community. The other is Keith Miller, who's a Protestant evangelical, a geologist, and who's very much in the effort to promote good science teaching in Kansas. And they've been very vocal because they thought that as representatives of the theistic side of this issue, it was important for them to communicate to other theists,
mm-hmm.
to carry the message to them that they've been able to work out a satisfying reconciliation between what they do as scientists and what they are as Christians. That's an extremely important message, but they've chosen to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Except for that, we really don't talk to each other about our personal religious beliefs. We just don't.
Right.
We find other things that we have so much in common, we don't really... It really doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of humanists are maybe not those humanists you talk to at this conference, but a lot of humanists feel the same way, that someone like Kenneth Miller is fighting the good fight, and
mm-hmm.
that he is promoting evolution. And regardless of whether he thinks God put this whole thing in process or not, he's in favor of teaching science in the science classroom, and so he is an advocate, and so would be an ally of ours, I think.
He absolutely is an ally. And the thing that the non-religious community has to understand is this. Religious freedom cuts both ways, right? The freedom not to believe, right? The freedom that we have as non-believers is the freedom that other people have as believers. And however they work out these personal reconciliations between their religious views, their personal religious views, and their acceptance of modern science is really up to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it really concerns us only to the extent that they might try to ask the government to favor their religious views, which our allies in the religious community are not doing. Right? That's what they're least likely to do.
Mm-hmm.
They have more in common with us than people realize. And so as long as they respect my right not to believe, I am perfectly happy with their right to believe and to express it, right?
Right.
Because they're helping us.
Yeah. What do you think about Francis Collins being considered to head the NIH? I've had people write to me at the Humanist saying that they're very concerned about that. And it's not just because that he might personally believe, but that he has in the past in a position of authority spoken about the Creator in this whole process.
He's never compromised his science. I don't know of a single instance in which he has ever compromised his role as a scientist with his personal beliefs as a Christian. And until and unless he does that, no one has any reason to complain about his being appointed to head the NIH. He's a competent scientist who's done some absolutely outstanding work. And the fact that he's a devout Christian should have nothing to do with it until he brings his Christianity into his role as a scientist and compromises that role. And I don't know of anyone who's ever accused him of doing that.
So until he does that.
People need to chill.
Okay. Can I quote you on that in
you
the magazine?
You may absolutely quote me on that.
Thank you so much for talking to us, Dr. Forrest, and enjoy the rest of the conference.
Well, thank you for having me, and this has been so enjoyable, and thank you for honoring me with the Pioneer Award. It's really a very nice award to have.
That was Jenda Huang and Jennifer Bardi interviewing Barbara Forrest.
And you can learn more about Barbara Forrest, learn more about her book, and purchase it at the book's website, which is www.creationismstrojanhorse.com.
Up next, we're going to hear from Donald Johansson, who is the director of Arizona State University's Institute of Human Origins. Johansson is most popular for his discovery 35 years ago of the 3.2 million-year-old hominid fossil known as Lucy.
And in the clip that we're going to hear, he's actually going to be discussing Lucy and the importance of kind of making sure that, you know, kind of the science surrounding fossils and whatnot isn't kind of, you know, hidden from the public or kept in some back storage room in a museum, but that it's out and it's accessible for people kind of everywhere from around the world.
So he just wants to bring the science to the people.
Exactly.
Yes. I like that.
Thank you. Good morning, fellow humanists. One of the more welcome groups that I attend and catch up on human origins from time to time. I want to thank you for being here and welcome you to Arizona, and to apologize this morning. My car wouldn't start. I borrowed a neighbor's car, so as I was driving down there, I was thinking, these things are not very intelligently designed. I want to go back to one thing that Robert said in his wonderful introduction, for which I thank you very much indeed, and that is this somewhat controversial exhibit called Lucy's Legacy. And interestingly, when I was writing this book, I was with my literary agent in New York at a lunch, and my working title was really The Legacy of Lucy. And he said, you know, it'd be a lot nicer if you just call it Lucy's Legacy. So we called it Lucy's Legacy. And lo and behold, the Houston Museum of Natural Science had an exhibit called Lucy's Legacy. So they have nothing to do with one another. But I did go to that exhibit, much to the consternation of some of my scientific colleagues, who asked me not to go to that exhibit, because they thought that I was reinforcing the idea of putting at risk and traveling an irreplaceable fossil such as Lucy, and that I should not participate and condone that sort of behavior. The government of Ethiopia, in fact, the Prime Minister, Meles Zenawi, had condoned that and, in fact, directed that Lucy travel as an ambassador, so that people around the world would see that Ethiopia was not just a country of famine and war and disaster, but it was Gesundheit, also a country that has contributed greatly to the understanding of the unity of humankind. And so the exhibit was extraordinarily controversial. It was boycotted by a number of museums, as you probably know. The American Museum of Natural History in New York is not taking it because they feel that it is, they don't want to condone the traveling of human fossils, yet they'll travel the most delicate of dinosaurs and so on. And in doing so, and the Smithsonian has also refused to take it, the California Academy of Sciences, and on and on and on. And in doing so, it elevates humans to that level of uniqueness, where we are separate from all the rest of the world, which is precisely what we as humanists are trying to counteract. That we are here through the same process as every other animal. Each and every one of us in this room is unique and special. And each and every one of us in this room gets on an airplane and maybe flies to Phoenix, Arizona. And if that plane goes down, that's the loss of a unique, important, special individual. So I have not really gone out and said a great deal about this exhibit, but I feel that it has enlightened people in a way that is extraordinary. There was a creationist at one of my talks, I believe it was in Georgia. When called on, he just stood up in the back of the room and said, "You know why? How many of you in this room have seen Lucy?" he said. And of course, I was the only one who could raise my hand. He said, "Exactly. You see, that's it. He has seen her, but none of us have because she doesn't exist. He has made this up. These scientists are lying to us." And now there are close to 800,000, or maybe a million people, who visited the museum in Houston and in Seattle who can say, "I saw her." And especially all of those little school kids who have come in, who have been bussed in, and who are fascinated by Lucy. Not threatened, not worried, not concerned. Doesn't affect their view of the world in terms of it's not an attack on their view as a religious person or whatever. It is a fact. It is something that they saw. So when someone says to one of these little fourth or fifth grade students, "Oh, you know, Lucy doesn't exist," this little fourth or fifth grade student's going to say, "Oh, yes, she did. She does. I saw her with my own eyes." Following the exhibit in Seattle, how many have seen Lucy on exhibit in this room? Have you seen her in Seattle?
Seattle.
Yeah. And some in Houston, I imagine. Well, how difficult it was for me to come and give a talk this morning in my hometown where I live. Yet I could, you know, I gave a lecture last week in Stockholm without any trouble. But when I was in Stockholm at the Natural History Museum last week, there were a number of people who had heard about Lucy traveling, and they asked me what was going to happen to her now. Because, as you may know, if any of you have followed it, there has been no venue that has taken her. Partly because, for heaven's sakes, let's not let these secrets out of the ivory tower and let the ordinary person see them. Let's keep them hidden in some museum somewhere. Or let's not, you know, as I said before, the pinnacle of evolution. A number of museums, such as the Field Museum and the Denver Museum and others who were going to take the exhibit, have simply run out of money. We're living in a difficult time. Well, someone intervened, and Lucy is going on display for 5 months. And she's going on display in what many people call the center of the universe. What might that be? New York City. Someone say New York? But she's not going to the American Museum of Natural History. She's going to the center of New York City. She's going to where there is more foot traffic than in any other place on the planet. And where might that be? Times Square. So now you know that when I go to New York City and I go to the American Museum of Natural History, they're going to say, "Oh, Don, how you have popularized this thing. She's at Times Square." Well, I'm going to say she wouldn't be at Times Square if you had taken her here at the American Museum of Natural History. She's going to be there for 5 months, starting June 24th. I've just found this out last week. And she is going to be in a new exhibit center that has been developed by the Discovery Channel. And it's going to be partnered with memorabilia from the Titanic. So there will be a big marquee. And you can imagine, to the horror of my colleagues, that will say Titanic and below it Lucy's Legacy on West 44th Street. And she will be there till October 24th. And I know many of you will travel or probably live nearby or in the East or whatever, and will make an effort to come and see Lucy's Legacy and the Hidden Treasures of Ethiopia. This is the first time I've spoken about this publicly. I just found out about it, as I said, when I came back from Stockholm on Monday. Lucy in the sky with diamonds.
And that was Donald Johansson. And for everyone who's listening who's in New York City or planning to be traveling on the East Coast, Lucy is still going to be at Times Square until October 25th. So you still have that chance to kind of go see her for yourself and be able to refute any future creationists that you run into. So you can actually learn more about the exhibit if you go to lucyexhibition.hmns.org.
And Jenna, that reminds me, our listeners can also get to any of the websites that we've plugged from this show. So Neil deGrasse Tyson's website at the Hayden Planetarium, Barbara Forrest's website for her book, and also this Lucy exhibition website from our podcast show notes page, if you will. That address is AmericanHumanist.org/HNN/podcast. And at that page, you can also listen to previous episodes and you can read transcripts and just learn about all of our past shows. So, Jenda, that about wraps up our show.
Yep. I'm a man of few words.
Thank you so much for being here. It was so much more fun to be in this little box of ours, not sweating by myself this month.
I'm glad to do it, and definitely I will be back next month.
Awesome. But until next month, tell listeners how they can be in touch with Humanist Network News.
Yeah, definitely. They can keep reading our e-zine, which you can find at AmericanHumanist.org/HNN.
And also, we would love to hear from you folks. We currently do not have a listener comment line, but you can send us emails at HNN@AmericanHumanist.org. And for those of you who subscribe to the HNN podcast via RSS, you'll need to know that we have a new RSS feed address. And that address is feeds.feedburner.com/HNN_podcast. So feeds.feedburner.com/HNN_podcast. And you'll notice that we've only put a few of our more recent episodes on that new feed. We've got a promo on there. We've got a sort of highlight reel show. And then our most recent three episodes, including this month. If you still are interested in downloading any of our archive shows, you can do that from our website, AmericanHumanist.org/HNN/podcast. Those are always going to be available to you. And you can always still read the show notes and the transcripts for those shows. So, Jenda, today's a very special day.
Yes, yes.
Happy birthday to you, right?
Yep. I'm turning 29, so I think getting close to the big 30.
That's right. You've been alive for 3 decades.
Almost. It's kind of scary when you think about it. Yep. So
what are your plans? Where do you see yourself in the next 5 years?
Yeah, I have no idea. sometimes I can't think more than 2 weeks ahead of time, so who knows? Hopefully doing something important, interesting, and relevant, but we'll see.
Nice. Well, I hope that you have a fabulous rest of your day. Thank you for spending your birthday here with me in Albany.
No problem.
You're a trooper. And folks, tune in next time. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Jenda Huang.
Thank you.